All right. We have, last week, 2 weeks ago, we did the prologue to the whole plan of God in Scripture, and that showed us the need for salvation. Last week, we began with Act 1 and covered the first two scenes. If you're going to do your little drawings, and I'll put those up as we go along, you can either go back to the sheet you started last week and just finish it out and keep all of Act 1 on one sheet, or if you wish, you can start on the new sheet. Your choice. Scene 1 last week was the founding fathers. Who were the founding fathers? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All right? And then the balance of Genesis was taken up with Joseph. And from chapter 37 through 50 of Genesis, we have the story of Joseph. And, of course, Jacob comes in a little bit at the end there. But the story of Joseph, which was so fundamental in the progress of what was going on, it got the people into Egypt. And Egypt becomes a kind of incubator where God grows the nation. And the people, when they come out of Egypt, are a few more than when they went in. How many went in? 70 went in, and who knows how many came out. And then we had exile and growth. That was called exile and growth. The exile in Egypt. Now, let me, so that I, because I'll probably forget later, let me refer you to the little diagram on the left-hand side with the red bobbles on it, which are supposed to indicate something. You see the two men, right? The first man indicated there is Noah. God has created, he has populated the earth with Adam and Eve and their children, and then he narrows it down to Noah and begins again. Then the next one is Abraham. He narrows it down to Abraham and begins again in a very different way, right? With Noah, he began again with the population of the earth. With Abraham, he begins with the population of faith. And Abraham becomes the father of those who have faith. Now, that's not to say there were none who had faith before Abraham, but Abraham becomes clearly, as Scripture says, the father of those who have faith. So that's the flow of things. And then, of course, we come along and the nation grows from Abraham. And then there's that bracket, and that's Egypt. The bracket where they, the brackets which enclose that period of over 400 years when the people were in Egypt. That's a long time. But we talked about that last week. Now we come to the Exodus. And when we come to the Exodus, we come to one of the great touchstones of Israel's faith and one of the great touchstones of our faith as we have adopted it from them. The 70 people go in, and then so many more come out. And what I'd like to do, let me, if I may, just read the verses in Exodus chapter 1 and kind of follow the flow here as it goes. Exodus chapter 1, beginning at verse 5, the descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. All right, there's the growth. This growth, the growth that we talked about last time, spills over into the first two chapters of Exodus. And there's the central statement of it. Then we come to verse 8. So what we have in verses 5 to 7 is that they have 70 people, but they multiplied, right? Then we come to verse 8. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. Now that gives you kind of a little sense of how much they had grown, right? The Pharaoh is afraid that if they join Egypt's enemies, there will be enough to defeat the nation. That indicates a lot of people. And then we come to verse 11. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. So they're enslaved and they're building the cities. Verse 12. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so the Egyptians came to dread. That's the word my version uses. They came to dread the Israelites. An amazing growth. I mean, the whole thrust of that section is to express the growth of the nation of Israel, the growth of the people. Well, the midwives come along. We come to the case of the midwives, and where it says chapter 1, verse 20 there, let me go back to verse 19. The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They're vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. You know, Pharaoh has this little scheme that he's going to have the midwives. I don't know how realistic he thought this was. These are midwives who deliver babies, and he wants them to kill the babies? Kill the boys? I mean, that's pretty unrealistic to begin with. Now, whether the midwives lied to Pharaoh, surely all of the women couldn't have actually delivered their babies before the midwives got there. Whether they lied to him or not is an open question. But it's possible that God arranged it so that they did pop the babies before the midwives arrived. But that seems... We're left in the dark on that. I don't know. But anyway, that was their response to Pharaoh. And the whole thing comes together in such a way that it's just emphasizing God's superintending the growth of the nation. He makes the Israelites fruitful so that they have a lot of babies, and then he prevents the midwives. He prevents the killing of them by as ordered by Pharaoh. All right, so that's the whole. I believe a central point of them being in Egypt. They're in Egypt for 400 years. They have plenty of time, a number of generations, and the people can grow to significant numbers. Then we come to chapter 3. And when we come to chapter 3, we have something new, and this new thing is what we'll focus on for a minute, and I want to draw a lesson from that. Somebody read for us, please, chapter 3, verses 7 through 10. Chapter 3, verse 7 through 10?
Okay.
All right.
The Lord said, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt."
Thanks. See what? Do you hear what the Lord said? He said two things. He said, "I have come down to rescue them. Now you go. That's what I'm doing. Now you do your part." There's the divine and the human. There's the God part and the man part. There's the God part that says, "I have come down to rescue them." Now, I don't know why God didn't just go into Pharaoh's mind and change his mind and make him think, "I got to let these people go." I don't know why he didn't do that. But instead of doing that, he chose Moses to go as the leader and speak to Pharaoh and say, "Let my people go." And of course, at first that didn't go too well. And then he had all these plagues that came and the people were allowed to go. There's a very interesting verse that I have thought about for years in Psalm 115, verse 16, and it goes like this. The heavens belong to the Lord, but the earth he has given to the children of men. What does that mean? The heavens belong to the Lord, but the earth he has given to the children of men. I think it means that God does not often intervene in our lives apart from people. That we're responsible for the earth. We're responsible to as he said in Genesis, rule the earth. We're responsible to develop the earth. We're responsible to administer the earth. And God lets people do it. Hands off. I don't know what you believe about all this sovereignty and stuff, but people are not puppets. And people have certain freedoms. And we are to exercise those freedoms, and we exercise them on the earth. We were made from the earth, and we were made for the earth. And we're responsible for the earth, and we're free to act in the earth. The heavens belong to the Lord, but the earth he has given. So God, when he is going to lead his people out of Egypt, chooses a human leader, Moses, and says, Moses, you lead them. All right? Does that make sense? Give that some thought and tell me sometime what you think, whether you think I'm on the right track or whether I'm taking that out of context. All right, now we come to an expression of that in chapter 13. Someone read for us verses 17 and 18 from chapter 13. Moses had already, God had sent Moses to speak to the elders of Israel. He's the leader, but the elders are responsible for the people. And so he sends him to the elders of Israel, and the elders approve what he's going to do, and then he's going to go and speak to Pharaoh and all that stuff. But look what it says in 17 and 18 of chapter 13. Someone?
When Pharaoh finally let the people go, God did not lead them along the main road that runs through Philistine territory, even though that was the shortest route to the promised land. God said, if the people are faced with a battle, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led them in a roundabout way through the wilderness toward the Red Sea. Thus the Israelites left Egypt like an army ready for battle.
Good, thank you. See what it said several times? God led them. God led them. God led them. That's what's happening. Moses may be the leader, but God's leading. God through Moses is leading the people. Now let's wrap up this scene so that we can go on to the others. This is now Act 1, Scene 3, right? And they're going out of Egypt. So you can you do this according to your artistic talents. I do it like this. You can just draw a triangle if you can't manage a three-dimensional pyramid, you can draw a triangle. That's the Exodus. That's them going out of Egypt, right? So we've covered 400 years in 5 minutes. We're doing all right. Now we come to scene four. When we come to scene four, we have, here's what we find. They're actually moving out of Egypt. They are, they travel 2 months to Mount Sinai. Now, let imagine that what you know the shape of the Sinai Peninsula, right? Inverted triangle, like this, kind of like what do you know like that? South Carolina, kind of the shape of South Carolina. So you draw a map of South Carolina, and chop off one quarter of it, and you have the size of the Sinai Peninsula. It's not as big as South Carolina. And you got Moses leading all these people through that region down to the south, down to, what, St. Matthew's or someplace down in the south, where you have Mount Sinai. And Moses leads these people out of Egypt from the northwest, down from the north, excuse me, you're facing this way, from the northwest down to Mount Sinai. It takes them about 2 months to travel down there. And then they're going to spend 40 years in that peninsula before they get into the promised land. But that's ahead of the story. Now, here's someone read for us, please, Exodus chapter 19, verses 3 through 6. You know the context of this. This is them when they have come to Mount Sinai. And I want to focus on something here that will, I think, be helpful in understanding what's going on. Chapter 19, verses 3 through 6.
Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession, although the whole earth is mine.
I'm sorry, where are you reading from, Larry?
Where?
Chapter 19.
This is in the Bible.
3 through 6. Yes, of course. Yeah. Then Moses.
Exodus.
I got it. I was just a little... I need new glasses. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, this is what you are to say to the house of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites.
Good, thanks. Here's what's happening. He says, you will be a holy nation. They're not a holy nation yet. They're just sort of a collection of tribes who have come out of Egypt. They're in the Sinai Peninsula. They're at the mountain. He said, here's what I'm going to do with you. I'm going to make of you a holy nation. God is going to give them something that is going to make them a holy nation. And here's what I think it is. He gives them the law. The law becomes their constitution. The law becomes what binds them together. And if you know anything about Judaism, the law is central to the whole issue, right? And it goes through the whole Old Testament period. It goes through the New Testament period. It goes through the tabernacle and all that. The law is central. If there's anything that's central to Judaism, it's the law. Not the Ten Commandments. The whole Pentateuch. The whole thing. Now think about this. Who knows the first clause of the First Amendment of the American Constitution? Give it to us. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or restricting the free exercise thereof. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or restricting the free exercise thereof. What's the first commandment? You shall have no other gods before me. See how different they are? Congress shall not restrict religion. God restricts it absolutely. You shall have no other gods before me. We live under a secular constitution that allows freedom of religion. They lived under a religious constitution that absolutely prescribed their religion. So think of it this way. There are about, I think, six Muslim Islamic states. There are six Islamic states which have the Quran and Sharia as their law. Out of, I think there are about 50 majority Muslim nations, but six of them have Sharia as their law. That means that their whole life is governed by Sharia. Our laws are not like that. They're secular laws. They're laws which have God gave the law in the beginning, the whole Torah, Genesis through Deuteronomy. Our government has developed the laws and writes the laws continuously, right? So that, I don't know how many laws there are. Thousands. But they've developed over time as originated by the mind of man as opposed to this which is revealed from the mind of God. That's different. That's very different. Very different. Let me suggest to you three things that this means. Number one, I think it means that there's the difference between a theocracy and a secular Republican government, or a secular republic, as we call it, right? There's a theocracy and a secular republic. That's the difference between Judaism and our government. Secondly, we have that which I just mentioned, God-given laws versus man-made laws. God-given laws versus man-made laws. That's a vastly different situation. Thirdly, the government of the Jews was religious in nature. I mean, if you read through the laws, yeah, I mean, some of them certainly sound like our laws. Anybody who sheds man's blood by his shall, how's it go? Anybody? Yeah. So they sound kind of like our laws, but they're laws that were prescribed by God versus laws that were created by man. Now they're similar at points, but they're very, very different at points. Anybody who violated the Sabbath was in trouble with the law. Children who cursed their parents were subject to the death penalty. I mean, there are vast differences between, and then there's the whole body of law in Leviticus regarding the priesthood and the temple and the sacrifices and all that stuff that is totally foreign to ours. And so in Judaism, religion was mandated, you shall have no other gods before me. In our nation, religion is free, so that anyone is free to practice their religion or to not practice any religion at all. That's what God was giving them. That's what God was giving the people of Israel at that time. He was giving them a constitution. He was giving them something to govern their national life. He was giving them a framework for a whole new culture. I don't know how much the Israelites in Egypt practiced the kind of things that God prescribed in the law before he prescribed the law. But certainly after he prescribed the law, their responsibility was to practice what God had given them in the law, and therefore that was to shape their culture. Just as the Constitution to a large degree shapes our culture, that law was to shape their culture, and their culture became distinctive as a result of that. Now, God not only gave them the law, but he gave them his own presence. And let's skip down to chapter 40, beginning at 34. And someone to read for us 34 to 38, please. Yes.
Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And throughout all their journeys, whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the sons of Israel would set out. But if the cloud was not taken up, they did not set out until the day when it was taken up. For throughout all their journeys, the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and there was fire in it by night.
The tabernacle, the place where God revealed himself, the place where God, he said, I will live with you in that place. So God took up residence, in a sense. You know, I'm speaking in very limited terms. God took up residence in that tabernacle, and his presence went with them. He not only gave them his laws, he not only gave them words, but he gave them himself. He gave them his presence. And his presence was evident in the tabernacle. And when Moses went to the tabernacle, he met with God. That's an amazing thing. And that's how God guided them. Whenever his presence lifted from the tabernacle and moved on, the people moved on. And he would move them to another place and move them to... I don't know how many times they moved during that 40 years in the wilderness. But, I mean, moving that many people and that tabernacle was no overnight thing, right? I mean, you couldn't just pick up in an hour and go. It would take several days to pack up and get ready. But they were moving on, and God was leading them. And then let me just close very, very quickly this section with and talk a little bit about Leviticus. Leviticus is a legislative book where God lays out the laws. And largely, not altogether, but largely the ceremonial laws, largely the laws having to do with the temple and tabernacle and the feasts and the priesthood and all that stuff. And so he gives us offerings in the first seven chapters. He goes through the various kinds of offerings that the people were to make. And then he talks about the priesthood beginning in chapter 8. They were consecrated to the Lord. This segment of the population were consecrated to the Lord for his service. And then he gives a number of commands regarding ceremonies in the later chapters. And then he gives commands. And the pronouncement is, if you obey me, I will bless you. If you obey me, I will bless you. He gave them the commands. He gave them this constitution for their governance. And he said, if you obey that constitution, if you obey those commands, I will bless you. And that blessing will be maintained. So in a sense, that's the place to wrap up this whole idea of the law and the commands and the constitution that Leviticus gives us in more detail than perhaps the other books, than Exodus or Deuteronomy. Their government, their culture, their life is centered in the tabernacle, the place where God comes down to meet with them. Randy?
All right, stand up and don't move. Okay, here we go. Ready? Creation, fall, blood, battle, promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, growth. All right, the next big point is the Exodus. Just going to turn 45 degrees and march in place. They're leaving Egypt. Okay. All right, then turn back around. The next part is the law. You have your hands together. And then you open up. Now you're not just opening a book; you're going to spread about. So you got the two tablets. Get the little, okay. So you just go the law. Okay. So Exodus, and then turn back around the law. All right. From the beginning, ready? Creation, fall, blood, battle, promise to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, growth, Exodus. The law. Very good. Have a seat.
Good. And there it is. There's the one I missed, right? There's scene four, the law. The two tablets of the law. That's not hard to draw. All right. Let's see how far we get on the last three scenes, which are not nearly as complex as the previous. A wandering people, scene five. If we begin at the beginning of Numbers, here's what we have at the beginning of Numbers. Numbers chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. The Lord spoke to Moses in the tent of meeting in the desert of Sinai on the first day of the second month of the second year after the Israelites came out of Egypt. He said, take a census of the whole Israelite community by their clans and families, listing every man by name one by one. And so Moses takes a census. They were at Sinai for a year, a little over a year. They stayed at Sinai. It took them 2 months to get to Sinai. They stayed there a little over a year, and then they're going to take off. And God has them take a census, has Moses take a census. And then we have in the following chapter, in Numbers chapter 2, we have the layout of the camps. the different clans have different allocations as to where they are to camp in relation to the center of the camp. And so it's very organized. I mean, you have to organize that many people. And so Moses organizes them very cleverly, and they know exactly where to camp when they come to a new encampment place. But the people don't really do very well, do they? I mean, right after they're given the law, they've got this golden calf thing. And they really don't pick up very well on what God is doing. And so we come to chapter 14, and somebody will read for us, please, chapters 14, 20 to 23. So they had sent these, what we traditionally call spies. They sent a reconnaissance team into the land to spy out the land. And they had come back, and Joshua and Caleb had given the God-centered report, and the other guys had given the man-centered report. They're afraid of what's going to happen to them if they go in there. And so these two guys stand out as those who are giving the true report. The people rebelled, and they said, "We don't want to go into the land." So God said, "Okay, I'll give you 40 years to die off." And he kept them in the wilderness 40 years. And they didn't go into the land. The next generation went into the land. And so you've only got Joshua and Caleb, these two guys who were faithful, who go into the land with the next generation. The first generation dies off in the wilderness. I don't know what's an analogy to that in our lives. Is how much do we have to refuse God before he said, "Okay, I'll just let you die off"? That's radical. That's really radical. That God has a whole, he keeps that people in the wilderness for 40 years until a whole generation dies off. And then he's going to take them into the land. Now, if we look at Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 3, just for the sake of touching Deuteronomy, I wanted to read this one verse. Deuteronomy 1:3, "In the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month, Moses proclaimed to the Israelites all the Lord had commanded him concerning them." And what we have in Deuteronomy is, Deuteronomy means the second law, but it's really an enunciation of the law. It's a compilation of, I think, three speeches by Moses before the people go into the land. Moses himself, of course, is not allowed to go into the land, but the people are allowed to go into the land, and so it's a compilation of Moses' exit speeches as he instructs the people as they're going into the land. And then Moses dies, and the people are under Joshua. So here's what we have in that scene, in scene 5. In scene 5, we have the Sinai Peninsula like that. And we have the people starting here at Sinai and just sort of wandering in the wilderness. That's at least how we'll symbolize it. I don't know what route they took to wander, but they wandered. And for 40 years, God keeps them in the wilderness so that generation dies off. It doesn't look very promising. God has given them the law. He's given them this constitution to rule their national life, and they're not doing real well. Okay? Then we come to Joshua and Judges. And when we come to Joshua and Judges, we have the conquest of the land. And we can read, someone can read for us, please, Joshua 10, 40 to 42. Joshua 10, beginning at verse 40. Good, thank you. See that principle again? God fought with them, but Joshua was a leader. Joshua was the human leader, but God fought with them. There's that combination of the divine and the human again. And so that we have there the conquest of the land. The Lord fought for them. I don't know what our response would be today if this happened today. If this conquest of the land happened today, we have a very different view of things today, right? We would call it invasion and genocide. But God wanted his people in that land, and so he led them into that land, and they conquered the land and took it. They didn't conquer it completely. They didn't actually conquer it completely until the time of King David, but they made a good start, all right? And then we come to the division of the land in chapter 21. Chapter 21, 43 to 45. So the Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give their ancestors, and they took possession of it and settled there. The Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their ancestors. No one of their enemies withstood them, and the Lord gave all their enemies into their hands. Not one of all the Lord's promises to Israel failed. Every one was fulfilled. That's Joshua's role. Joshua's role is to lead them into the land, conquer the people, take possession of the land, and settle there. And then we come to Judges, and we finish up with Judges. When we come to Judges, what we have is the people, and I think probably, but let's do that. Let's read. Someone read for us, please, Judges 2, 10 through 17. That's what happened with the judges. It was generation after generation of a judge coming along, calling them to the Lord. They come to the Lord, and then they rebel. They come to the Lord, then they rebel. They come to, and it just keeps going back and forth, generation after generation, under the judges. what we have basically is a collection of tribes in the land, not really unified yet as a nation. We'll see that next week. They're not really yet unified as a nation. They're a collection of tribes in the land. These judges come along and attempt to bring them back to the Lord, but they're never very successful. There are people in the land, but they are not united. There are people in the land, but not united. Now, we know that from the book of Judges, there are a few shining examples of judges who really come through for the Lord and do great things, but the people as a whole, I think we have to end in looking at Judges in chapter 21, verse 25, the last, I think that's the last verse of Judges. Let me read it for you. In those days, this is the last, here's the verdict. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. That's the definition of anarchy. That's the state of the people of Israel as we leave them at the end of the book of Judges, anarchy.